Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every week at 11 o'clock on Wednesdays, we broadcast live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, conversations about taste, one of my favorite topics, because, of course, conversations about taste are about food, at least the ones that we have. And today we have with us someone with probably almost more influence in the realm of food than anyone when it comes to how we cook and eat, and it's Melissa Clark. And thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Mitchell. Wow, that's a big compliment.
Well, when you think about the recipes that people turn to when they open their New York Times, yep, or when they trade on, you know, if they're shopping in various areas, I see your name pops up and your style of food pops up so often. It's so great. And I feel like you really, just today, my partner Nate emailed me because of some chocolate cherry bars that he needs to have for Valentine's Day. So,
well, I'm my sweet tooth is sort of just out there this month, and it's just going to be all about chocolate. And I really do. I love that I can influence people at all.
And I mean, you do it really where it counts. I think we talk about food so much as an intellectual pursuit. We talk about restaurants, we talk about chefs, yeah, but when you talk about what people are cooking, I mean, you're really the intermediary. You work with chefs. You've co-authored some wonderful books and also authored some on your own, but you get inside our kitchens, inside our family meals, in the places where food really, really matters.
It's actually funny. I would say it's the exact opposite. I would say that the world gets into my kitchen.
I guess that's true.
Or everybody, right? Not the world, but the people who read the column, because that's the stuff that what I'm writing and what I'm publishing in the Times is 100% the stuff that I'm eating,
right,
and not just, so often I'm hired to develop recipes for this or for that or for some special project, or I'm writing someone else's cookbooks and I'm working with their vision and what they do in their restaurant. And then I think, well, how do I take restaurant food? It's right, a constant battle, taking a restaurant recipe and turning it into something that not only people could possibly do in their home kitchen, but that they would want to do.
Let's talk about that, yeah, a little more, because I think we forget that piece. Yeah. Certainly even, I think, publishers and people who are interested in food but don't know how to cook that much forget that piece, because chefs have become so influential and they're such celebrities and we love them, but we don't cook like chefs, do we?
No, we really don't. And, I really do feel like I'm smack in the middle of this divide, mm-hmm, because the food that I cook is very much, it's informed home cook's food, mm-hmm, informed in that I get to eat out a lot, and I do eat out a lot. So I'm always trying new things and new influences. I'm reading all the magazines. If there's a new ingredient, I'm out there, I'm buying it, I'm trying it. And then maybe so are you. But, I don't do chef's food. Is it's elaborate. I mean, even the simplest restaurants, even the places where you think, oh, this is just the most pristine piece of fish with this little sauce, well, that little sauce probably took the chef 3 days to make,
right?
And that's what we're paying for, and that's what we love,
but it's not what
we want to cook, right, necessarily.
And that chef has a staff to help and,
yes,
people to clean, and is going to use it for the next month, and so,
yes, exactly. But on the other side of it, I also have people who come to me. I mean, I do a lot of co-authoring for non-chefs too,
mm-hmm,
and I have people who come to me and they say, anything with more than 5 ingredients scares me. Or how do I, the biggest question I get so often is, how do I roast a chicken? And, the answer is, well, if you put it in the oven with salt and pepper on it, it's going to taste good pretty much no matter what you do. But even that step is, it's a whole chicken. I've never,
right,
done anything beyond a chicken breast. So there is this huge cultural divide between, the people who are, serious cooks who are going out, who are kind of like me, informed home cooks, but,
right,
informed and serious. And then people who really need to get dinner on the table quickly. They want good food. They want it made well, but they're a little bit intimidated by anything that they just haven't done before. Mm. It doesn't even matter what it is. If anything you haven't done is scary, right? Something new is scary. Even if for me, something as easy as a whole chicken, for them, it's like, well, wait, what's inside that? What is that bag of stuff inside my,
right,
chicken? That can be a real stopping point. Parchment paper. A friend,
okay,
of mine said every time she sees a recipe that calls for parchment paper, she turns the page because, well, now you can buy it, but a few years ago you couldn't find it anywhere.
Right. So, and that stops you. And if you're not sure,
yes,
what you're doing or what it's for, you don't want to just throw in a piece of aluminum foil or...
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And I mean, that goes back to what we're talking about, recipes. A well-written recipe has to, be able to get both to capture both audiences. So I have to be able to say to my friend who doesn't want to use parchment paper in the recipe, you know what, wax paper, fine, foil, fine, you know, a little Pam, you're good. But then on the other side, I don't want to dumb it down to the people who know what parchment paper is, and in fact know what a, you know, chipotle chilies and adobo sauce is. You know, you have to really walk, for me, what I feel like I have to do is walk that line and make it as accessible as possible without losing the people who are more informed.
Right. And I would say, I think you do that really well. And partly what I love about your column in the Times is you talk people through the process. You know, you sort of see, you look, you often write about an idea that becomes a recipe, that becomes a dish that then people sort of either prepare or use as a jumping point for their own ideas and their own dishes.
That's the goal. I mean, really what I want people to get out there and do is just cook more for their families, cook more at home. And if I can influence people in any way, that's, you know, like, that's what I want it to be. Just cook more. Just, you know, go out, just buy something fresh and go home and cook it. And in the column, really what I'm trying to do is give people a starting point, and they should take it in their own direction. And I love that. I mean, it really does seem to work. I get a lot of email from people who've tried my recipes, and they say, but wait, I didn't have this, so I use this, just like you would. Like, yes, just like, right, I would. And of course, if it doesn't come out well, it's my fault. But if it does come out well, it's all them. And that's fine too. Right.
There's always that, well, the thermometer on my oven is off, or my regular,
yeah, exactly,
right, my pineapple wasn't as sweet.
Yeah, I didn't have chicken,
like,
so right, I used fish, but the recipe, right, didn't, you know.
But people do that too. I mean, yeah, the funny thing that I find when you talk to people who cook your or anyone's recipes, yeah, is you assume that you know the things you can change, that and still make a chicken dish, that a chicken dish requires chicken, for instance, you know.
Yes.
But you're often asked questions, you know, well, I didn't put it in a pan, I didn't use a chicken, I didn't whatever, and it,
right,
didn't quite come out like your picture.
Exactly. Right.
So let's talk a little, what do you think, besides the new, why is five ingredients the limit? What are we afraid of? I mean, what, you know, I've always wondered, a recipe that has to sit on the stove and cook for 2 hours doesn't take any more effort than one that cooks for 10 minutes if you just put it all in the same pot, but we're afraid of that. What do you think that's
about? Yeah, so
why do,
yeah, you know, that's really interesting, because the last cookbook that I wrote, Cook This Now,
yes,
my publisher kept saying, are these fast meals? Are they fast? Are they fast? And I, well, they're easy, you know, it doesn't,
right,
and like what I was trying to really push was, well, no, some of them, yes, yeah, some of them are super fast, but some of them are, it takes 3 minutes to mix the beans and the garlic and the olive oil in the pot, but you know what? You have to let it sit there for 2 hours. You can be playing with your child,
right,
you could be watching,
right,
TV, you
on
could
your
be,
iPad.
Yeah, you could be emailing, you could be doing work, but yes, the pot needs to cook. And there's something about it not being fast that was, it was a real, you know, they really wanted me to make it fast,
right,
and I didn't. I made it, I kept it simple, but I kept it true, because there's not, I think there are two things going on. I think the first thing is the idea that a meal that the only things that people cook are the things that they want to get on the table for dinner that night, and everybody gets home from work at 6, everybody,
mm-hmm,
or 5, and
mm-hmm,
they want dinner on the table half an hour later. And you know what? That's just not the way everybody cooks.
No.
It's the way a lot of people cook, but people have slow cookers, and people also can, some people work at home a lot. More people commute and work from home.
Sure.
And you know what? You can take 15 minutes in the middle of the day to put your casserole or whatever in the oven and then let it sit there.
Mm.
And it's just a slight readjustment in the way that people think, and also the way that we are marketed to.
Right, key. I think,
yeah,
that's actually key.
You know, I mean, for my publisher, they really wanted to be able to put on the label fast.
Right.
And they couldn't. And they were, I mean, it was fine in the end, but it was definitely a marketing thing that they think that is exactly what American cooks want. And I think that that's actually not the full story.
I think that's really an important point. So, and I'm curious about this idea. Like, I'm always concerned. We invented fast food in America as though every culture doesn't have a fast food, and we want to eat quickly, and we want to spend no time in the kitchen. And one of the things that I think is really important to make that shift is that actually time in the kitchen isn't wasted if the end result is a delicious meal.
Yeah, and well, I think that's another thing that people who are marketing to Americans don't realize, is that the kitchen is have you noticed in American homes, the kitchen is the center of the home. It is the center. That is where we want to gather together. So why not cook together? And a lot of families do, and that's great. But that should be the message. The message should be, you know what? The time you spent, just what you said, it's not wasted time. That time, I always say that the time you spend, the extra 15 minutes that it takes to make something fresh rather than heating up something frozen, that is the best way to show someone that you love them. What is more powerful than cooking something fresh for someone you love? Nothing. You can make them a card. You can tell them that you love them. You can sing them a little song. Well, actually, singing a little song is actually good, too. But I mean, really, I think...
coming over to your house. Sounds like fun.
We do a lot of singing. But really, I mean, when it comes down to it, feeding someone something that you cooked, I mean, come on, right?
Sure.
That's not wasted time. That is family time. That is love time. And that is just... it's a gift.
Did you hear that, people at home? And we're approaching Valentine's Day.
Yes,
and
I think, exactly.
Yes, Melissa
exactly.
is telling you.
Cook something fresh.
Right.
Or, you know what?
Save yourself the hassle of a restaurant, which is crammed to the gills with people who just want two tops in these spaces made for four and six.
Yeah, no, you know what? Restaurant, it's all about eating at home. Yeah. Get something special. You know, even if it's just, you know, the simplest thing in the entire world, it's still special if you've cooked it yourself.
I do think something else about the restaurant and chef culture we're in... makes cooking at home a challenge for some people, and that is that our tastes and our experiences have become so much more sophisticated, and then when we go in the kitchen we expect that result.
Level. Exactly.
And it can be doubly more frustrating if you spend the time and it doesn't taste as good as you could just go buy it on the corner.
That is such a good point, and I think that's a real problem with people who are just adamant restaurant goers, and they're afraid to cook in their own kitchens. They're afraid to make something simple because they're afraid, oh, it's not going to be as good. And you know what? The thing is that it is as good. It's different. And it's, but there's nothing, I mean, if you can afford to go out to really high-end restaurants and you can afford to get an incredible piece of fish or meat. Like for Valentine's Day, this is what I'm making. You want to hear? So I'm going to get an incredible rib steak with the bone in, and it's going to be grass-fed, but it's going to be...
You just said that and I started salivating.
Yeah, rib steak with the bone in, and I am going to rub this thing down with lemon zest and coarse salt and ground juniper and pepper. But you can take out the lemon zest and the juniper. Just salt and pepper, that'll do it. But good salt, good pepper, good meat. And then I am going to sear the heck out of it. Uh-huh. And it's going to be bloody rare and oozing in the middle. And it's going to be crispy and brown and golden on the ends. And oh my God, what is better than that? Not hard, people. Not hard.
Your husband does know how lucky he is, doesn't he?
Most of the time, yeah.
Yeah. Although I imagine...
when he's left with the dishes, though, sometimes he's probably like, really? We couldn't order in?
I imagine sometimes you have to cook when maybe you might not want to. We forget that part of a professional life of a food writer, recipe writer.
You know, I sometimes I'll spend all day in the kitchen cooking, but there'll be nothing to eat by the end of it.
Right.
You know, because it'll be stuff that's like, it's either all desserts or it's, you know, like I did a bunch of pizzas. I'm doing the Franny's cookbook and I made 8 pizzas the other day. And you know what? Those are just not good for dinner a couple hours later. You know, they just don't hold. And so I had been cooking all day. And at the end of it, I was just, we were starving. And so we ordered in. Big deal. We had falafel.
Well, we have a question.
Oh, a question.
Yes,
oh,
from
goody.
A listener, which is great. And this listener asks, given your role and sphere of influence at the Times, how does it play into your decision that she makes for her work? It's one thing to design recipes for the home cook, but do you think about your role at the Times and how that might influence taste or other food trends in our society? Well,
yes, I do.
Yes.
I do, actually. Like, for example, I don't know if anybody has noticed, but in the Times, we're trying to not use any fish that's not sustainable fish. That's been a decision that we made globally. I mean, I kind of made it individually, but then it just became this global thing. So I don't know if anybody's noticed, but I've been calling for a lot of mackerel lately and a lot of mussels and things that are really sustainable. In terms of meat, I've been trying to do more vegetable and grain focused recipes.
Uh-huh.
You know, the sugar thing is hard. The sugar thing is hard because we don't do a lot of sweets, but when I do sweets, I want
sweet.
Yeah. So, I mean,
it's funny,
I'm not encouraging moderation in that, except I don't have them all the time.
Right. And there is a trend in not sweet desserts, but those are ultimately unsatisfying.
They don't do it for me anyway.
Right.
You know, I love the idea of ending the meal with just like a little piece of cheese and, you know, or a little anchovy, something very British, a savory. But the fact is, really what I want.
Right. It's a gooey
what I
chocolate.
Really want. Yeah. Right. So, but again, you know, in moderation. I mean, and I don't say it explicitly in the column, but the sweet stuff, it's for Valentine's Day, my latest column. It's chocolate ganache. You make it as a treat,
right,
you know.
Right. And that's the key. I mean, I know this sounds ridiculous and cliche, but moderation is sort of the key to all of this.
Yeah.
Even about cooking. I mean, you can have elaborate, you know, multi-hour meals, and then sometimes you just have a quick little something with a leftover sauce and a blah, blah, blah. We kind of forget that it isn't all or nothing in the kitchen as it isn't all or nothing on the plate.
Well, right. And that's important, too. I mean, you have to do what works for your family. I mean, the bottom line is if it's just too hard or it's too intimidating or it's too whatever it is,
right,
and you're not going to do it, then what's the point? You know, and you really need to... you kind of need to know yourself as a cook, too, I think. People forget. You know, they forget their skill sets. They forget the stuff they like.
Very key. Well, and there was just a piece in the Times today about mindful eating, but
yes,
I think we're talking about is mindful cooking.
Mindful
being,
cooking,
being
yeah,
aware of what's going on and adapting to that.
Right, and what your capabilities are, not just as a cook, but in your kitchen. I mean, I love when people call me up, and I don't love it, but I kind of, like, I get this, like, you know, I kind of cringe and my stomach ties up into a knot. So I ran out to buy this, you know, this really expensive piece of kitchen equipment so I could make this one recipe that, you know, it takes 5 days. And can you walk me through it? And I'm thinking, you know what? Can I tell you how to scramble an egg really well? Like, this is the best scrambled egg recipe you've ever had. And all you need is a wooden spoon and a little skillet and a lot of butter.
And then you have breakfast for dinner, which is one of our favorite meals at home.
Oh, we love that.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Melissa Clark talking about taste and cooking.
Ice cream man, upon my street, I love your truck outside, really neat. Now ice cream man, upon my block, I love your chimes, sir, they reel and rock. Now ice cream man, please ring your bell,
ding, ding,
and play that music that I've grown to love.
Ding, ding.
Now
ice cream man,
please ring those chimes for me, ding, ding, on this afternoon so fine. Now
ice cream man,
upon my street, I love your truck, you know that it's...
Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we love to tell their stories. Brooklyn Brine grew from a two-person moonlighting operation to an eight-person production force in Gowanus in just 1 year, churning out pickle varieties like chipotle carrots and lavender asparagus. Come have a taste in one of our six Manhattan locations.
Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I should give everyone the message at home that you can call us with questions at 718-897-2128, or you can write us at...
497.
Sorry.
It's okay.
497 says the voice of God, and I don't even know where that came from. 718-497-2128, or info@heritageradionetwork.com. And let's see, Whole Foods Lavender Asparagus. We're very pleased to be sponsored by Whole Foods, but that's something I might have to go try.
The lavender asparagus pickle. Yeah, that definitely, you know, okay, but here's the thing. So when I go out to eat, I always order the thing on the menu that sounds the least attractive to me, the least likely, because it's like, you know what? Maybe lavender and asparagus is the best thing in the whole world, and it just... doesn't sound like it to me.
I should eat with you and not my partner, Nate, because I do exactly the same thing, and he just looks at me like, why on earth?
Because you get...
It must be there for a reason.
Exactly. Like the first time I had raw kale salad, you know, these days we all... raw kale salad, it's a cliche. First time I saw raw kale salad on a menu, it was a while ago, and I thought, raw kale sounds absolutely disgusting, but I am at a really good restaurant, so it was at Franny's, it must be good. And it was great.
And it's great.
And
every
great
time I make one, I think, how can this be so delicious and so easy?
Is exactly right. So take risks, take chances.
Indeed. Don't be afraid. Let's get back to I'm sort of fascinated by the recipe itself as a literary genre almost.
Oh,
I know,
yes.
That's a kind of ridiculous thing to say, but I do think that there are trends in recipe writing that we don't always acknowledge, and I think we're in a moment where people are playing with recipes, just the sort of the way they're situated, the way that they're trying to translate the taste of a chef, for instance, or of a recipe writer, or even a sort of ethos of a restaurant. I'm thinking of the recipes in Lucky Peach magazine, the Momofuku Endeavor, or some of the books like Mission Chinese Food, or even some of the electronic what do you call them, food websites, I guess, trying to play with the way that
we
work through.
Right, or recipes on the iPad.
Yeah, iPad. So what do you think about where we are with recipes
actually,
right now?
Actually, you know, it's funny. I was just talking to a group of people who are designing recipes for the iPad, and I said to them, I was like, you know, the way that we write a recipe right now, where we have the mise en place, we have all the ingredients and how they're supposed to be, you know, prepared and gotten
ready. In advance, exactly.
You know, and that, and then the steps, the techniques, that's a very recent conceit. That is not, it's not like this, again, the word of God. This is not the recipe writing from God who's told us this is exactly how we should write a recipe. This is very, very recent. I'm not exactly sure when it dates back, but if you look at early cookbooks, you know, they're written in paragraph form. The whole recipe, or word of mouth. When you tell someone a recipe, you don't say, well, okay, you need to compile 2 carrots grated to equal 2/3 of a cup and, you know, whatever.
Right.
You just say, well, you take your carrots and you... And so there's this real... and on the one hand, those recipes that are written the way that we expect them to, we're used to them. We've adapted to them. Our eyes know how to read them. And if any home cook sees something different, it can be a little bit off-putting just because it's not what we have... come to expect. But we've lost something in that. There's not a lot of personality that fits in that particular form. If you can get personality into that form, you are an excellent recipe writer. My hat goes off to you. But there's so many better ways to tell the story of a recipe. And a recipe can be a story, and it can be a conversation, and it can be a starting point. And I love recipes that do that. And I even if I don't cook them, and I do cook them.
Right.
You know, I like the idea that a recipe will tell me something that I didn't know about a particular kind of food or a dish or the person who wrote it or the day, whatever it is. It just takes me somewhere else and adds an extra layer on. I think that's really special. And I've been seeing that more and more. And we used to see it. I mean, those old recipe books, you know, you read them and you really understand the cook. You understand the time. You understand the ingredients that they had to work with. And that is fascinating. So I would like to see more of that. And I think that the iPad is particularly, or technology, not necessarily the iPad. I mean, any kind of technology can be really well suited to that because you can go back and forth in different screen views. So you can see the traditional recipe, but then you can see something different. You can see something more, something with depth. And I'd love to see that really integrated in a way that can be both useful and informative and exciting.
Sure. Well, if you're listening at home, start writing those recipes.
Well,
and
start thinking about, you know, that there are other ways to tell the story of a dish. Think of a recipe as not just a way, this is how you make the dish.
A list of steps, right.
Yeah. Think of it as also the story of the dish.
Right. I think that's really good advice. And I do think that we've lost a little bit of the seduction of recipes that you have when you read Elizabeth David or you read some of these. I mean, you don't have to go to that particular cliche of Elizabeth David,
but
definitely there are, like you said, there can be personality too. And I do think that this question of understanding is part of it, because if you know a lot about food when you start, or you grew up in a culture where everyone's mother made the same dishes and you know what we're talking about, then what you need to say is a little bit different to communicate. You can just have a list and people can figure out how the pasta goes with the sauce. But when we're cooking food from around the world, when we have ingredients from, you know, on our doorstep from all the corners of the earth, you need something else.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. But and you know, you have to worry about it getting too wordy. I mean, people obviously want to be able to make the recipe. That's really important. But there are some recipes that you really can tell really simply and that most people are going to understand. You know, like a roasted vegetable recipe.
Okay.
I can tell it to you right now. Like,
do it.
This is how I do every roasted vegetable under the sun. If it's a vegetable and it stops long enough for me to cut it into pieces, I will roast it. Take a dense vegetable. What do you like? Cauliflower, carrots, beets, anything that you like. Cut it up into the size that you want it to be when you eat it, a little bit bigger because it's going to shrink. So think about do I want it to be a big piece or a small piece? That's important.
Again, mindful cooking.
Yes.
Pay attention to what you want.
Exactly. Right. Very important. And then take that. So you take these pieces of vegetables. If they have skins and you don't like the skins, peel the skins. If they have skins and you do like them, for example, I keep the skins on my carrots. I peel my beets.
Interesting.
Cauliflower, just cut it up. Broccoli. Toss it with a ton of oil. You need a lot of oil. And this is important because the oil is what's conducting the heat and cooking the vegetable. It's not just the heat of the oven. It's the heat of the oven through the oil. I don't exactly know how the science works of it, but I just know that the more oil, the better.
What type of oil do you use?
That's up to you. Olive oil is my kind of go-to. I have it in the little thing right next to the bottle next to my stove.
Uh-huh.
But coconut oil is great. Butter, if you're going to do it at a low temperature so it doesn't burn, you can do it at like 350. But nut oils, peanut oil.
Uh-huh.
Peanut oil good peanut oil, like cold pressed peanut oil that actually tastes like
peanuts. Smells like peanuts.
Oh, yeah. That is so delicious with eggplant. Cut up the eggplant, put the peanut oil on it, a little bit of sesame, a little bit of soy sauce, and some chopped cilantro. It is so good. Chili sauce too. But and then so your your basic ingredients is your oil, your vegetable. You need your salt. You need your good salt. You can have pepper or not. You can have red pepper. You could have black pepper. You could have, you know, Szechuan peppercorns crushed up. You can leave it there, or sometimes I'll put a little bit of whole spices, crushed coriander, crushed cumin. Sometimes I won't. And you want to spread it out on a baking pan so that there's lots of room in between the vegetables. That way it gets brown on all sides. If you crowd it, you're going to steam it. High heat. I like to use around 400. Mm-hmm. And then just put it in there. And then when you start to smell it, stir it. So use your nose.
Right,
you know?
Right,
you know?
Right.
That's a good
tip. Be aware.
Or you can set a timer and do it after like 10 or 15 minutes. But I was like, oh, that smells good. I think I'll stir it. And then it's going to...
In 70 seconds, Melissa, you've just given people probably 35 recipes that they could make.
I hope so. Mushrooms. Oh, mushrooms are so good that way.
Right.
You do a higher heat on mushrooms and get them really brown. And then when you take it out of the oven, it's ready to eat right then. Or you can add lemon, you can add a dressing, you can add chili sauce, sesame, soy, a dollop of yogurt with salt. Stir it into the yogurt.
Oh.
Delicious.
Okay. So we have a question from Marcel, who's listening at home, and she wants to know, what are your 5 must-have cooking tools? A question
she
you probably...
actually edited the question to add, for a busy single girl.
Okay. God is listening today. He keeps coming into our headphones. It's really nice.
Wait, does that mean God's a guy?
Well, maybe the...
okay,
he didn't sound like George Burns. Anyway, so Marcel says, for a single gal, what are the 5 must-have cooking tools?
You know, I would say for anybody. I mean, they're pretty much the same thing, whether you're single, married, you know, a man, a woman, right. You know, a cooking cat. You need a sharp knife. You got to have a cutting board. You know, those are just, you know, I think you need something to sharpen your knife.
That's
important. You know, even getting one of those little cheapo things that you can buy.
Sharpening steel?
Keep it, or buy a stainless steel knife that keeps its edge and that you can then, you know, replace, like one of those $35 jobs. You don't need a vegetable peeler, but I use my vegetable peeler about 10 times a day, probably because I have a small child, so maybe that doesn't work for the single person. But
just to peel, or do you actually make strips of vegetables or anything, or cheese or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I use it a lot for cheese. It's great for cheese over pasta, cheese over salads. I just find it useful, but you can use a paring knife if you're a purist. Of course, you need to have your... Oh, gosh, how am I going to do this in just 5? You need to have your, you know, you need your mixing bowls. I'm just going to cheat and just going to go on. Okay, you need your mixing bowls. You really need to have your, I think that if you're going to get one skillet, you should get a saute pan instead of a skillet. And the difference is it has the high sides.
Okay.
So if you have one pan, get a skillet has slope sides. A saute pan has high sides that are straight and it has a cover on it. So you can use that saute pan, get a 10-inch or a 12-inch. You can use it to fry things on top of the stove. You can also use it instead of a stew pot, instead of a Dutch oven, and then you can braise things because it has a cover. Because there's enough depth and because it has a cover. So that is a really good tool. I mean, you need your pasta pot, and yes, you need your colander because you're probably going to make pasta and, you know, you want to drain it in something. Don't use a tennis racket. Like, what was that movie?
I didn't see that movie, but that's pretty great.
I know that, I love my salad spinner, but a lot of people think that that's really you could just use a pillowcase and you go shake, shake, shake.
I love my microplane for zester, but cheese grater and garlic masher, and
it's good, and ginger really fine ginger. Microplane is fantastic.
Okay, so that's maybe 10 things, Marcel, but we're not talking $1 million. The hurdle should never be I don't have the right things to cook, because you can cook on a camping stove and you can cook, you know, without electricity, and you can do all sorts of things, right?
Yeah, and really also don't go crazy with the knives, you know. Really, one knife is... And maybe a bread knife if you like to cut, you know, really crusty bread at home. Although I know there's some people who think you can use your chef knife.
Yes.
Yeah, but I'm not one of them. I like my bread knife. But you don't go crazy. Don't buy a million knives. You don't need them.
Okay, here's my last question. And this I think, can make or break a home cook when it comes to the recipe. And it's this question of doing something to taste, seasoning to taste.
Yes.
To taste? And as the writer of a recipe or the translator of a chef's recipe, how do you communicate to someone who has not made this what it's supposed to taste like?
Well, that's the thing. It's not supposed to taste like anything. That's the thing. It's supposed to taste like how you, the cook, want it to taste. I can give you the basic guidelines, but I can't tell you how salty you like it. I can't tell you how lemony you like it. I can't tell you how oily you like it. You know that. Trust yourself, please. This is like another thing I really want cooks to be able to do, is to trust themselves a little bit. If you make something and you start to eat it and you go, yeah, don't keep eating it. Fix it. Come on. Fix it, okay. People. And you can do that really easily.
So the first thing is probably salt. No?
Yes. Salt, lemon, and oil. Okay. Those are the three things that will fix pretty much anything. If not lemon, then vinegar. Because it's probably off in the dish. It's either not salty enough, so it tastes bland, or it doesn't have brightness. A lot of food gets finished with a little bit of lemon or a little bit of vinegar, especially food that I make and food that I love. And everybody has a different tolerance for that. So you might need to really bring it up if you're a person who likes bright flavors like I am. So just balancing the salt and the lemon or the salt and the vinegar is really important. And then olive oil. Olive oil is great, or butter or some kind of a little bit of fat, because sometimes things are too lean and they're too, you know, you eat them and you think, the texture is off. For a voluptuous, really silky texture, you probably need a little bit of fat at the end. If you add the fat at the beginning, it might not have that same mouthfeel. So if you're getting something and it just feels weird in your mouth, add a little bit of fat. And you don't need much, a teaspoon, two teaspoons, just to round it out. That's probably going to fix it. And if not, okay, second, so that's the first tier. Second tier, you know, chili sauce will fit. A little sriracha will fix anything. Right. Chopped fresh herbs brighten things. They make things beautiful, and they really can add a lot of flavor. A little bit of soy sauce. Soy sauce has that umami thing going on, you know? Uh-huh. So that will fix, you know, if you, a little soy sauce, something just tastes flat or just not appealing. Also, if you've used mediocre stock in a soup, you know, and you know you've done it. I've done it. You know, you buy the container because you're out of your homemade chicken stock. You just don't have any more in your freezer.
Or so you've never made a chicken stock.
Or you've never made a chicken stock. No, I'm talking about you, Mitchell. So you use the jarred stuff, you know, the stuff in the container, and it's flat soy sauce. Seriously, because it has that umami flavor, and it really adds a lot of depth and dimension. So I will often, you know, when I'm making soup or stew and it's just not quite right, I'll throw some soy sauce in there. Worcestershire works the same way.
Fantastic. So in 30 minutes, I think we've given you probably 500 million recipes based on what you've heard from
Melissa.
Oh, I could
go on and on, too.
You could, but don't spoil it, because every week we look forward to opening the Times and to your next... Are you working on a book right now? Oh, the Franny's
cookbook. I'm working on the Franny's cookbook right now, which is going to be fantastic.
We'll look forward to that. Thank you so much for being with us here.
Thank you. This was fun.
And next week, we're going to be welcoming Gail Simmons to Bushwick, who's going to be talking about her new memoir, Eating With My Mouthful, Talking With My Mouthful.
You can't eat with your mouth empty.
No. That's true, but maybe we should try. We'll have a show on that. Anyway, you're listening to Taste Matters. You can download the podcast on iTunes, and you can listen on to our archive on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Have a good and delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.